You're tuned in to the Kojo Namdi Show on WAMU 88.5. Welcome. This week we're participating in Covering Climate Now, a global media initiative focused on telling the climate change story. Today we turn our attention to the district. This was an unusually hot and wet summer, and you've probably seen the effects in your own backyard, from dangerous algae in the rivers to rivers of stormwater flooding your street. That might soon be the new normal. But when it comes to living with the consequences of climate change, it's not an equal experience, even though it will affect all of us. Marginalized communities throughout the region will see different and more severe impacts from climate change. And when you're struggling to put food on the table, activism and disaster preparedness can be understandably low on your agenda. Here to tell us about climate justice and how DC is planning to stay resilient is Jacob Fenston. He is the environment reporter here at WMU. Jacob, always a pleasure.
Hi, Kojo.
Also in studio with us is Kevin Bush, DC's Chief Resilience Officer. Kevin Bush, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Kojo.
And Malini Ranganathan is an Associate Professor in the School of International Service at American University. Malini, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Kojo.
Jacob, let's start with you. You've been doing some reporting on resilience and how the DC region is starting to mitigate climate change impacts. What have you learned about the risks we're facing?
Well, there are a lot of risks in terms of climate change, and there's basically three sort of big categories of climate change that the DC region will experience. And I did a story this morning, talked about there's three W's: warmer, wetter, and wilder. It's going to be warmer is a pretty obvious one, and you mentioned that with the weather this summer. Just looking at the number of 90 degree days this summer, there were basically 3 weeks more 90 degree days than the historical average this summer in DC. That's the sort of weather that will sort of characterize the future as the planet warms up. We're also expected the sea levels rising here. We're on two tidal rivers, and the sea level's risen about a foot so far, and it's expected to rise. You know, we don't know how much more, but it could be 6 feet in extreme scenarios. It's, I guess, physically plausible that it could rise up to 11 feet by the end of the century, which is a lot and would, you know, cover things like national airports. So, and then also extreme weather is the third W, wilder weather. So, you know, things like the July 8th storm, where is that Monday morning and it rained a month's worth of rain in an hour, that sort of thing is what climate scientists tell us will become much more common in the future.
Kevin Bush, you're DC's first ever resilience officer. Can you give us a sense of what your job description entails and how climate change plays into the work your office does overall?
Sure thing. So resilience in DC, the way we think about it is in order to best prepare for the future, you have to understand both the chronic stresses that DC and our residents go through every day, things like the high cost of housing, stressed transportation networks, you name it, and also look at the potential acute shocks that might impact DC. So that could be many of the things that Jacob just mentioned. It could also be a federal government shutdown or, you know, SafeTrack even, right? It makes a big impact on folks' life. And the only way to plan for those things is to do so holistically, where you're addressing the underlying stresses that weaken our ability to withstand any of these major shocks when they do happen.
So what does it mean in that context for you to make the district more resilient?
So we actually just put out a plan in April. The mayor released DC's first ever resilience strategy. And it takes this holistic view at building urban resilience. There's 68 initiatives in the strategy, four goals. We focus on the idea that you need to thrive in the face of change, looking at climate change, changes in technology, and then also even population and economic growth, right? We're at 702,000 folks now in DC. We're expected to get to 1 million by, I think, 2040. And that puts a major strain on the system. So the strategy, which is up on resilient.dc.gov, lays out all of these initiatives in pretty great detail.
Malini, earlier this summer, you and a colleague published an article titled "From Urban Resilience to Abolitionist Climate Justice in Washington, D.C." Now that we know a little bit more about resilience, can you define climate justice for us?
The term climate justice most broadly refers to the fact that those that are least responsible for climate change are likely to bear its gravest impacts in a kind of very broad sense. In the context of the United States, the term climate justice is very closely associated with the terms environmental justice and environmental racism, both of which came out of the civil rights movement. In the late 70s and early 80s, leaders and organizers who came out of the civil rights movement started to take stock of environmental hazards, things like toxic wastes and industries and trash dumps that were disproportionately borne by low-income people of color. And what they pointed out at the time was that, in fact, race is a greater predictor than class, even, of the location of hazardous facilities. And thus the term environmental racism was coined. And environmental justice is a broader term, as defined by sociologist Robert Bullard, who's one of the founders of the movement. The idea, the principle that all people should be entitled to equal protection under environmental and health laws. So drawing inspiration from these terms from the civil rights movement, climate justice has become a rallying call for frontline communities to pay attention to underlying socioeconomic and racial inequities that are likely to be exacerbated by climate-induced harm, harm that's disproportionately borne by low-income Black, Brown, and Indigenous people in the country.
Malini, how did you go about doing your research and what conclusions did you come to?
We know that climate change is going to be a threat multiplier, right? What that means is that climate change is likely to reinforce underlying vulnerabilities, things like food security, insecurity, and housing insecurity, and even mobility insecurity, that is the lack of ability to get from place A to place B because of the lack of transit networks or the lack of a personal vehicle. We wanted to understand these inequities beyond aggregate numbers. In other words, we wanted to put a human face to these numbers, Kojo, right? We wanted to understand the stories that give texture to gross numbers of inequity that, that the city government has been very thorough in documenting. So we designed a climate vulnerability survey and we implemented it in Ward 7's Kenilworth, Parkside, and Eastland Gardens neighborhoods. These are areas that are predominantly low-income and African-American. And we combined this with archival research and oral histories from residents. In fact, Justin Leaney, the ANC commissioner in part of Ward 7, took us on an environmental history bicycle tour just to point out the various harms that have been done historically in that region. And what we found was that what we're calling intersectional harms, right? The kind of compounding of food insecurity with housing insecurity, with mobility insecurity, right? All of these are likely to be worsened by climate shocks. For instance, we spoke to an elderly woman in Eastland Gardens whose husband's dialysis machine stopped working during the last storm because of a power outage. Now, without the ability to jump on a bus or even get in the car because of mobility insecurity, they weren't able to get into a hospital in time. You know, these are the types of intersecting threats that we're looking at in the district.
Jacob Fenston, you've been reporting on the environment at WMU for a while now. How have you seen climate extremes impact the region already?
Well, there's a lot of ways, and I think you know, just talking about sort of environmental justice and climate justice, you know, we could talk about heat, and there was a recent study about the urban heat island effect, where I went out with one of the researchers. They're driving around DC with thermometers, basically measuring all the different neighborhoods, and they found, you know, more than 10 degree difference in temperatures from certain neighborhoods, you know, closer to Rock Creek Park, for example, areas that had more trees, which also tended to be the wealthier neighborhoods, compared to a lot of more low-income neighborhoods where there aren't as many trees and where there's more sort of, you know, asphalt that absorbs the heat. You could look at, you could talk about flooding. You know, it costs a lot of money to fix your basement if it floods. And a lot of the flooding, like this July 8th flooding I was talking about, a lot of that is happening in places that aren't in the floodplain, that people don't have flood insurance. So even if you, you know, own your house, you may not, you know, a few thousand dollars to fix your basement could really harm you. So I think that there's a lot of, you could look at any of the impacts of climate change and look at ways that they are disproportionately, you know, already impacting people in the city.
Kevin Bush, what are some of the threats created by climate change that your office is looking into?
Well, Jacob did a really good job, I think, of outlining many of them. And You know, what I think is important that Molly's research has highlighted is this fact that many of these risks, these impacts intersect with other issues that are already ongoing in these communities. You know, Jacob talked about a historical lack of trees in certain neighborhoods of D.C. And in part, what we're trying to do in the district is recognize those disproportionate harms that are caused by climate change and address them. So, for instance, we plant more trees every year in Wards 7 and 8 than we do in Wards 4 and 5 because we've got some catching up to do, and the urban heat island can be greater in some of those neighborhoods. Also, on the flood side that Jacob mentioned, you know, FEMA, every year they put out these floodplain maps. You know, everyone talks about the 100-year floodplain. That's great for telling you your historical risk along bodies of water. What it's not great at doing is those types of floods that Jacob's talking about, where it rains a bunch and suddenly basements in Bloomingdale are flooding. And so we're actually investing, I think it's somewhere around $5 million over the next couple of years to develop a digital twin of DC that allows us to model how water moves underground in stormwater pipes above ground, and be able to look at how things like sea level rise will impact flooding in areas far away from the river.
Got to take a short break because, as you know, this is our fall membership campaign, and we'd love for you to become a member of WAMU. But if you have called, stay on the line. If you'd like to join this conversation, you can call 800-433-8850 or send us a tweet at Kojo Show. I'm Kojo Namdi.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily. Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Welcome back. We're talking about climate change in this region, the possible effects and the effects that we are already seeing here in the Washington area in general and in Washington, D.C. in particular. Joining me in studio is Jacob Fenston. He is the environment reporter here at WAMU. Kevin Bush is D.C.'s chief resilience officer. And Malini Ranganathan is an associate professor in the School of International Service at American University. I should point out that WAMU is licensed to American University. But Malini, from your experience, how are people in the district experiencing climate change right now, and how might they in the future?
I think there are two really pertinent examples here. One is food insecurity, which is very closely tied to the racial wealth gap in the district. You know, statistics show that the wealthiest and whitest wards have up to 10 grocery stores per ward, whereas there are only 3 grocery stores for all of Ward 7 and 8. That's 150,000 people, right? If you imagine that it's difficult, you have to take 2 buses to get to a grocery store, right, under so quote-unquote normal times, right, you can well imagine when there's a kind of disruption how that's going to be affected. And food is very much related to health. The second thing is let's look at asthma. Right. The 2018 DC Health Equity Report says that a quarter of residents in Ward 8 report that they have been diagnosed with adult asthma. That's nearly twice the proportion for the highest income, whitest wards. And pediatric emergency visits, room visits for asthma is 30 times higher for Ward 7 and 8 than for the wealthier wards. Now, asthma, okay, given that it's disproportionately borne by poor and African-American residents of the district, is likely to get worse on warmer days. So we've seen this past summer, Code Orange days, right? That means high levels of surface ozone, poor air quality. those folks suffering asthma are going to face especially difficult times as the weather warms. And as we saw on your show yesterday, people are talking about spikes, right? That's what we're worried about, spikes in temperature, spikes in rainfall. And those are unpredictable but are happening. And that's really going to be a problem for people already suffering health problems.
If you live in Ward 7 or Ward 8, give us a call. Tell us how it's been affecting you, especially if you're troubled with asthma. 800-433-8850. You have just described a variety of multiple effects that can occur, especially in poor areas of the cities. And you've referred to climate change having a multiplier effect on places where these disparities mm-hmm. exist. Explain how that works.
Well, by threat multiplier, what we're saying is that it's not just flooding per se that we're concerned about, or a very warm day where you're advised not to drive your car or you're advised to stay home. We're worried about the ways in which those extremes interact with, almost serve as a catalyst for other things that are going on in people's lives, right? And that's what we mean when we say threat multiplier.
We got a tweet from Mark who says, question for the guests. Is DC going to take this seriously, i.e. make hard decisions and act, or is this just another marketing exercise? I'll start with you, Kevin Bush.
I think we are taking it seriously. In my last job, I worked for the federal government and worked with cities across the country. And honestly, DC is doing more than most cities. And my counterparts over in New York and LA, we constantly compare notes and have a little bit of a battle over which city is doing more on climate change. We have more green buildings per square foot and per capita than any other city in the country, more green roofs per capita and per square foot. We put more solar up. We plant more trees every year, which is a great way to mitigate the impacts of urban heat and address things like asthma square foot than any other city in the country right now. So we're doing a lot. And then again, on the intersectionality issues, we're also doing a lot under Mayor Bowser's leadership to address some of these other issues that can be laid bare by climate change. We've got an unprecedented commitment to invest in affordable housing, and we've challenged the region to follow along and produce more units of housing, because if we don't keep up with that population growth figure that I mentioned earlier, then it's only going to become more unaffordable to live here. And when you have less money in your checking account at the end of the day, that makes you more vulnerable to things like hurricanes and heat waves.
Jacob Fenston, there's always the risk that good faith projects designed to protect us from something like flooding can have unintended consequences. Talk about efforts to fortify the DC waterfront and about Old Town Alexandria.
Yeah, so I did this story that I mentioned this morning, that part of it was about Old Town, which I think is really interesting example. But just first talking about DC, I think it's sort of fascinating that at the same moment that the sea level's rising on the rivers is when we are sort of turning back to the waterfronts, building these sort of fabulous new developments along the waterfronts, the wharf, the area around the Navy Yard, Poplar Point, Buzzard Point in the future, and then, National Harbor in Prince George's. Alexandria has a huge plan to do some more development along the waterfront. So this is all happening as the sea level's rising. And there are laws in place to, make sure that those buildings are built above a certain level of flooding, or that they're flood-proofed. But it's not in some sense, if you fortify one area of the waterfront, that could increase flooding elsewhere in the river. If there's a certain amount of water, it has to go somewhere. So that can have unintended consequences. And I think there's also planning takes a long time, and the science on sea level rise is evolving, and our understanding of how quickly it's happening, depending on the melting of ice sheets. It's changing quickly, and these planning processes, I'm not sure, are always keeping up. So Alexandria is an interesting example. They have been suffering from high tide flooding. It happens hundreds of times a year, where the high tide of the Potomac River kind of comes up over the sidewalk and into the streets. It's just sort of a normal thing along the waterfront there. So they have this plan they've been working on for a long time to raise the level of the waterfront, and they picked a level that's going to be about 2 or 3 feet above where it is now. That'll deal with basically the 20th century problem of sea level, and they weren't particularly focused on climate change. and how much higher the sea level will be. So now they're kind of looking back at the plan and figuring out ways they could add on to it in the future. But I just think that is an interesting example of ways in which this sort of huge global change isn't at the forefront always of planning efforts that take a long time.
When you mentioned what Alexandria is doing, is there potentially an issue with the data used by jurisdictions to make decisions about how to manage climate change?
I mean, I think that Kevin was talking about this mapping effort to look at not just the floodplains along the waterways, but also the ways in which the drainage in the city is can cause flooding when there's a big downpour. So I think there are things that we don't have a great handle on. I think there's a really interesting report from 2008, I think, which Malini mentions in her research that after flooding downtown in 2006 that flooded a bunch of federal headquarters, the National Capital Planning mm-hmm. Commission, they did this big sort of study of what happened and why. And it was very interesting because they were talking about a sea level rise of 1 foot in the next century, which is like not what we're expecting now. So that sort of just like sea level rise data is something that that again we're not necessarily keeping up with, and they also there was some kind of like head scratching about why this flooding happened. Since then there's been a lot of work to mitigate that sort of federal triangle flooding.
Malini, what critiques do you have of the district's current approach to climate preparedness?
I think more broadly, Kojo, our research issues a word of caution against top-down, big-money type approaches to resilience plans that are technologically and private sector driven and that do not sufficiently incorporate the voices, histories, and strategies of grassroots and frontline communities. So more broadly, I think we get into some critiques of the way in which the language of resilience planning has been deployed. I mean, you saw post-Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, some of the ways in which resilience dollars were spent did not directly benefit those who had been displaced, those who needed the relief money, those who needed efforts to genuinely make them resilient. So more broadly, I think our research does issue that word of caution against this kind of mainstream resilience planning. I think that being said, I think the district resilience study report, Resilient DC, does a commendable job in, for instance, talking about structural racism, right? It's actually mentioned. The history of redlining, the history of housing segregation is mentioned in the report. It does a good job also in talking about the affordability crisis in the district. One place where I feel they could have fleshed out a little bit more, and I say this with a lot of empathy because I know Kevin has certainly probably been living, eating, breathing the resilience report for the last two years, is the question of public housing. I think the word only appears twice, I think, in the whole report. And I think there's a public housing crisis in the district. There's no mention, let's say, of the black mold, of the pests, of the leaks, water leaks that units in the district experience. Tyrone Garrett, the head of the DC Housing Authority, has said that there's some $2.5 billion in deferred maintenance costs and that a third of all public housing units are unfit for human habitation. To me, that is a resilience gap. That is an environmental racism gap that we need to address if we are truly to address the climate vulnerability of our most marginalized populations.
Got to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll continue this conversation. If you have called, and I see many of you have, we'll get right to your calls. If you're trying to call and you can't get through, shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show or email to kojo@wamu.org. I'm Kojo Nandi. Welcome back. We're talking about D.C.'s resiliency and environmental justice, but you can't talk about D.C. without talking about surrounding jurisdictions. And Jacob Fenston, you brought up Alexandria. So here's Janice in Alexandria, Virginia. Janice, your turn.
Yes. Hi, good afternoon. The city's been discussing this for so many years, and nothing has been resolved. My question, though, is if they put a barrier at the foot of King Street in that entire area, what happens to the water that is cascading down King Street, because it's a very steep incline, pooling at the foot of the hill? We have a power outage. They cannot pump the water that is going to then back up into all of the houses. And a better plan would have been just less development on the waterfront with all of the hard surfaces.
This gets to the data issue that we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, and I don't know the the plan as well as probably you do, but I think there are two pumping stations involved in the plan, so that will get water out if there's not a power outage, and I don't know, the whole development question was very controversial. It's still very controversial along the waterfront there.
It is, and that's clearly what Janice is concerned about. Janice, thank you very much for your call. Malini, you talked about the fact that in Ward 7 and 8, where there's a great deal of public housing, the city may not be paying enough attention to the mold that's in those public housing. Why do you think climate justice is something that lawmakers sometimes struggle to take into account?
It's a very important question. I think climate change feels so large, and it feels as if there's not one thing in particular that can be done. And that's precisely the problem, but precisely the way we should be thinking about solutions as well, right, is that we need to attack it in this multi-sectoral, multi-pronged approach, which is exactly in the vein that Resilient DC, the report, is heading it in. So I think that there's an opportunity here to address some of these long-standing inequities, racial inequities in the district. Often talk about this being two cities, right? There's Washington, and then there's the district. This is an opportunity for the city to address some of these historical racisms and structural inequities. But I think that it also is a challenge. And I think that one of the ways to move ahead is to really listen to some of these stories in which people are experiencing these intersecting harms in order to design policy and practice that acts on those intersections.
And for you, Kevin, Kathy couldn't stay on the line, but she wanted to ask, does this new Office of Resilience give suggestions for how citizens can do their part, particularly those who are not well off? Is there any guidance for how people who are on a budget can do their part to fight climate change?
It's a great question, and in some ways it ties into actually what Malini was just talking about. And one of the interesting things that we're doing, I think in the same neighborhood that your research was focused in on, is if you go into a community that's struggling with paying their bills or finding food access, has real life day-to-day problems, and you say, hey, it might flood here in 10 years, you might get a blank stare back. And so what we've done through the Department of Energy and Environment is actually we formed in partnership with Prince Charitable Trusts an equity advisory group in the near northeast or far northeast neighborhoods, and asked them what they would do. And the beauty of the partnership with Prince is that they're actually compensated for their time, which is something that government typically can't do. But if you're really seeking deep community engagement, you kind of need to do, because folks have other priorities. And so one thing that this group has been able to highlight as a potential solution and need is this concept of resilience hubs, which we were talking mm-hmm. about before the show, mm-hmm. where you have the neighbors and residents programming the activities in a trusted place. In a day-to-day scenario, that can be where people come together after some sort of community trauma, like something to do with gun violence maybe. But when a major event, if and when it does happen, the resilience hub can also serve as an aggregating point. And if we put solar panels and battery storage on it, then maybe it'll also even be that beacon of light and power that allows folks to respond better when a disaster does occur.
Malini?
And just speaking with residents in the area, I think one of the things that's really an urgent need is jobs, right? And so how do we tie that need for job generation, income generation, with some of the strategies that are already being thought about already? And you know, there's clearly there's a good opportunity there, especially around green infrastructure or kind of regenerating the Anacostia River, which, Jacob, I know you've been covering a lot as well. You know, really folding in income generating opportunities within that so as to, as, you know, you're attacking multiple things at once. And I think that jobs question has to be central here as well.
Here's Charlie in D.C. Charlie, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. My big concern is infrastructure. So a couple months ago, we had some pretty torrential rains, and there were videos all over Facebook and Twitter of just gallons of water coming down through the metro. And if that is an initial signal of what is to come, we need to improve our infrastructure, our public transportation. I'm also concerned about the number of cars that are coming into the district and how much pollution and traffic that's generating, and I'm wondering if there's going to be any kind of car tax like New York just adopted for its downtown area, or other kinds of incentives to encourage people to move away from driving into the city to commuting on public transportation. So that's my question.
Well, Charlie, thank you very much for your question, but before Kevin Bush can address it, I'll go to Steve in Washington, who has a similar concern. Steve, did Charlie just speak for you?
Yes, Kojo. Thanks for taking my call. With regard to the higher asthma rates in a lot of these environmentally challenged areas of the city, I'm wondering if DC is going to take bold action and implement something like congestion pricing for cars in the city. We have some of the worst traffic in the nation, and that not only does it contribute to the causes of climate change, but obviously contributes to a lot of the causes for asthma and poor air quality.
Kevin.
On the congestion pricing issue, which, you know, a lot of cities are increasingly using, I think London has something similar too.
Yep.
We did put a commitment in the resilience strategy to study that for DC. There's some unique, you know, implications of the fact that we're the district. We're not a city or a state. We're city, county, state, all in one. There are certainly issues that we'd have to work through if something like that were to occur. On transportation, I think more broadly, one of the interesting overlaps between, you know, being more resilient to the impacts of climate change and also addressing the underlying causes, namely, you know, human-caused carbon pollution, is the preponderance of ways that we're getting now in DC to move around, right? You've got cars, obviously, but you also have dockless scooters, dockless bikes, dockless e-bikes. You know, you can catch a metro or a bus, or you can even walk places. And I personally think that makes us more resilient as well. Because when you look at any of the major events that have happened in the last couple of years, whether that's a major snowstorm or the earthquake, there's really quickly a lot of congestion out on the street. And the folks that get home first aren't the ones that live in faraway suburbs. They're the ones that can walk home or can bike home. And having that diversity of options from a transportation perspective also makes us more resilient.
Marlene, your research recommends an abolitionist approach to climate justice. What does that look like in practice?
The project of abolition, of course, in the 1800s, was about abolishing slavery. It was about emancipation. Later in the early 1900s, abolition became a trope through which African American intellectuals and activists, you know, imagined not as yet won freedoms. So W.E.B. Du Bois in Black Reconstruction talks about abolition democracy, right? The imperative of building up institutions and systems that are actively anti-racist, right? That conversation has also extended to mass incarceration. The abolition of the carceral state and mass incarceration has to be accompanied by the building up of institutions that would ensure that people are not on a path to prisons in the first place, right? So it basically aims to attack racism at its roots. And that conversation has been going on for generations in fields that are not environmental and that are not health. And so we call for bringing that conversation into the environment and health fields. After all, if EJ activists said that the environment is where we live, play, work, raise our children, and grow old, then it's time that we brought those conversations into this field. And so an abolitionist approach, as mentioned, centers these histories, centers these stories and strategies of grassroots communities that are already practicing resilience, right, without necessarily resorting to outsiders coming in. And essentially, it's about freedom and emancipation, and it's about those not as yet won freedoms. And I think it's time that we kind of rethink the environment as freedom in that sense. And so that's where the abolitionist imperative comes from.
Less than a minute left, but Joe on the Eastern Shore tweeted, "How prepared is the city for a stalled hurricane like Harvey? We're in the cone of uncertainty so often. We've been lucky so far, but it's only a matter of time." Kevin Bush, are we talking about a kind of new normal here?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we know about climate change is that it is already and will continue to make more frequent the really intense hurricanes. And in addition, when the oceans are warmer, those tropical storms and hurricanes suck up more moisture from the ocean, so they actually rain down more as well. And the stalled hurricane is something that, you know, Jacob and I were actually talking to about the interior flooding risks and why we're looking into where it floods on the inside of the city.
Kevin Bush, thank you so much for joining us. Malini Raghunathan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And Jacob Fenston, always a pleasure.
Thanks, Kojo.
Today's show was produced by Maura Curry. Coming up tomorrow, young people around the globe will take to the streets this Friday to demand meaningful action on climate change. We'll meet some of the young climate activists who are helping to organize the D.C. climate strike to learn more about how the next generation plans to fight and to live with climate change. That all starts tomorrow at noon. Until then, thank you for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi.
The Kojo Namdi Show is produced by Ruth Tam, Julie Deppenbrock, Margaret Barthel, Sydney Grannon, Maura Curry, and Victoria Chamberlain. Our managing producer is Mana Kashvi. Our engineer is Josephine Neonai. For past shows and more content, visit kojoshow.org.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Namdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.